Hello everyone and welcome to Learn Japanese Pod. You are listening to the Fun Friday edition where we temporarily put away our Japanese textbooks and talk to cool people doing cool things in Japan. And this week's guest is no exception. I am super excited to welcome Timothy Reed to the show, originally from North Yorkshire in the UK. Timothy is an award-winning musician who moved to Japan back in 2011 after graduating from the University of Leeds. And he started out like many foreigners, teaching English to get by. But everything changed in 2014 when he won a national guitar contest, which is pretty impressive. And that moment really launched him headfirst into the Japanese music scene. Since then, he's worn many hats, from studio musician to touring artist, in-store guitar demonstrator, teaching at various schools, and more recently, Timothy's been diving into the video game industry, working on a big mix of big title games and indie games. And it's been quite the journey for him, and I'm sure anyone interested in what it takes to succeed in the music industry in Japan and basically making a life in Japan, I'm sure you're going to enjoy this story. So, Timothy, welcome to the show.
Hi, Alex. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you on the show. It's been absolutely ages since I saw you in person, so it's really nice to hook up again and say hello. How have you been recently?
Yeah, it's great to hear from you. I'm doing good, thanks. As you mentioned in my fantastic introduction, thanks very much. I really appreciate that. Yeah, it's been busy, as it always is. You're still in Tokyo, right?
I'm in Tokyo, but I should mention to our listeners that Osaka is the birthplace of Learn Japanese Pod. So I lived in Osaka for 3 years. My heart is in Osaka. But anyway, I thought today, Timothy, we could split this podcast into three parts. And the first part is essentially, why Japan? How did you find yourself here? Part two is kind of talking about your career as a musician and your career in media and video games. And then kind of part three is that kind of transition to, you know, your current work, like what you're doing now. So part one, what first attracted you to Japan, and can you tell us a little about your first move to Japan, like what that was like?
Yeah, sure. I mean, this is essentially still my first move to Japan. This is still my first time in Japan. I haven't been back to the UK in 15 years. So,
wow,
it's kind of interesting when people say like, yeah, you know, this is your first time in Japan. And I'm like, yeah, but I've been here for 15 years.
15.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy. What originally drew me to Japan was probably very different than most people. Like, because I was born in the north of England, in Yorkshire. Mm. Mm. And this is like 20 years ago. So there wasn't really much in the way of like Japanese things, if you know what I mean. Mm. We had like, I mean, I guess other people had more than me, but I had four terrestrial channels on my television up until I was about 12 years old. Channel 1, 2, 3, and 4. And then when I was like 12, they brought in Channel 5.
Yeah.
And Channel 5 was great because Channel 5 was kind of out there. It showed like wrestling, like from America, and like ice hockey in the middle of the night and stuff. And as a kid, I was always like really into that kind of stuff. Like I was always really into anything that wasn't from the UK. I don't know why. I just had this, I'm not sure what it was. I mean, my mom used to listen to a lot of like Motown and soul music.
Oh, cool.
And she used to always kind of like play that. And I remember thinking like, oh, this is cool. Because it's, and she would be like, yeah, you don't get that kind of music here. You know what I mean? And it's like, and so I had this kind of thing. And so I think probably the first experience of me with Japan was probably playing video games, to be honest with you. So playing like the Super Nintendo, you know, growing up, and the Sega Mega Drive and all those systems. And then, but at that time, I had no idea that that was Japan.
Yeah.
You know, Super Nintendo could have been an American console for all I knew. I just thought it was fun. And It wasn't until I actually went to university. And I was in my first year of university. I studied music at university. And I had like a really boring class that was like music business.
Right.
And it was like, you know, you just sit in there for an hour and people would go to sleep. And, you know, you'd learn about like copyright, mechanical copyright and stuff like that, you know. And it just so happened that the guy sitting next to me was a Japanese bass player. And I have no idea why. I think it was just the fact I was sat next to him. Just at one time, he asked me, like, have you ever listened to any Japanese music? And I was like, no. And he gave me a big wad of copied CDs. You remember back in the day, we used to copy CDs, burn CDs.
Right, it was all
these, like, blank CDs with, like, written on in biro, like, the name of the artist. And I remember he had some like written in kanji, and I remember just thinking how cool that was, just purely because I had no idea what it was. It's like, I don't know what this is.
Right.
And I remember taking those CDs home and like burning them onto my computer, putting them on my iPod. And so basically he gave me a bunch of CDs, and like I'd never listened to any Japanese music, but this is going back like 20 years ago when...
Yeah.
When British music was like at that state where everything was super polished.
Yeah, right.
Production wise, like everything was like really sparkly and clean and like, you know, icy and like just hyper produced. And I remember listening to the Japanese CDs and just being like, this is like raw.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because a lot of the Japanese bands have that Beatles influence, and it's like, then the other thing as well is, you know, like, I mean, I don't want to get too deep in the topic because I'm not like super, not that knowledgeable about it. But have you ever noticed how like Japanese singers, they're like not as in key as we are?
Yeah, right.
And then we're not as in key as like the Indian singers, right? Because they have like 32 notes in their scales. So it's like, so I imagine when like Indian people listen to our music, they're like, wow, it's kind of out of tune. And I get the same feeling when I listen to Japanese music. I'm like, man, they're pretty out of tune. But it's kind of like, that was really refreshing for me back in the day, because it was like coming from all this super polished music to this stuff that was really raw. And so I just really liked that. And so I listened to those CDs like so much. And then the guy was like, if you want, we can like play these songs in a band.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah. And so I was like, yeah, sure. And so I got together with like another overseas student, and we were just like playing Japanese music, and they would speak in Japanese in the rehearsal. And I would be like, what are you guys saying? You know, like, what are you talking about? Cause I can't understand anything. And yeah, just one thing led to another. And it was like, okay, so after university, everyone's plan is to become a professional musician, which is, I mean, what does that even mean? And so my thing was like, oh, maybe I could go to Japan and be a professional musician in Japan. And so I was like, no one else in my uni had that kind of idea of that doing that. So I was like, maybe that's my unique thing. So it was complete luck, really, that I came to Japan. I mean, I knew I would have gone somewhere. I don't know where it would have been, maybe Canada or the United States or something. But just so happened to sit next to a Japanese bass player, get into Japanese music. And yeah, and the rest is history. 15 years later.
That was a lucky meeting. That's amazing. So when you first came to Japan, like, what did you come here as, like, as a tourist or as a student, or did you manage to find work? What was the first opportunity that allowed you to actually come here?
So I, for some reason, had this preconceived misconception that every foreigner in Japan speaks complete perfect Japanese and like and like is super high qualified and like the best in their industry, you know what I mean? Like, I don't know why. Yeah, I just it's like,
well, I think maybe in the 80s when Japan was, you know, their economy was booming, before Japan became popular through popular culture like anime, manga and music, I think from the MBA crowd, if you were doing economics or stuff like that, you get an MBA. And it was quite popular in the 80s to go to Japan to study for a year. And so those people were definitely kind of at the top of their game. And, you know, they spoke fluent Japanese, and they had a, you know, a degree from Harvard or Yale or something. And there was that kind of image. Now, Timothy, it's just us.
Yeah, I know, right, man? I know, right, man?
By the way, this podcast wouldn't exist if foreigners spoke perfect Japanese.
Right,
Japan.
That's so true, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so, yeah, I don't know, man. I just had that idea in my head. So, like, I met that Japanese dude in my first year of uni. I had 3 years left. And so I hit the textbooks, man. I was like, right. Oh. Yeah, I was like, I need to get on the ball and get up to that level because I want to make this work. And, you know, I already kind of had the idea that becoming a professional musician in itself, even in your own country where you speak the native language and you've got all those advantages, is already a hard enough task.
Of course.
So it was like, okay, so I need to be really ahead of the game here. So I bought, you name it. I've used it textbook wise, audiobook wise, website, flashcards, all those things, in order to study Japanese.
Did you attend official classes, or were you self-taught in those three years?
I didn't, because I was also studying at uni. So it was like, most of my time was taken up with my actual studies, and I studied music at university. So most of my time was taken up with that. And then I would have like 15 minutes downtime between classes where I would just literally headphones on, listen to whatever, learn Japanese pod. Cause that's actually how I think I originally met you. I think I reached out.
Oh, really?
You right. might not wow. remember that, man, but I think yeah, I reached out yeah. with you cause I think I was watching your podcast originally. So, yeah. And I think I would study that, and I would study kanji, writing kanji. Yeah, I haven't picked up a pen in years. I have forgotten all my kanji. I can write kanji on a cell phone. I'm a master on a cell phone. But with a pen, I can't even write English with a pen anymore.
Just a quick aside, a million years ago when I was a uni student learning Japanese, we wrote everything out by hand. There weren't iPhones and Androids and apps to help you learn kanji. It was pen and paper all the way. And now what's really interesting is that a lot of Japanese people I speak to, I say, it's getting harder and harder to write kanji because I'm only ever tapping on screens, right? Or like clicking my mouse on my PC or something. So yeah, it's a skill that's slowly going away.
Yeah, slowly fading away. Like, yeah, I mean, I probably got my kanji up to the level where... I mean, I don't even know, because I'm kind of like, I never went to the classes, which is, I guess, what we're kind of getting at here is I'm primarily essentially like a self-taught Japanese person,
right.
Japanese learner, which is why doing this podcast is really interesting for me because I do all the music podcasts.
Yeah.
Right. And when I do the music podcast, I talk about being like, a classically trained musician who right. is a self-taught Japanese speaker, but I just speak, Japanese is kind of, whereas on this podcast, we're talking specifically about Japanese, which is really cool for me, but also it's still kind of like a hobby for me. Whereas music isn't really a hobby. Music is like a job. So music is right. something I have to do, which is kind of the opposite to most people I meet.
Right. Right.
I'm like, I'm envious when like what you're saying there, like you studied Japanese, like, that's so cool to me. I would love that. For me would be fun to go in and learn, like, the kakijun, the writing order, stroke order right. for kanji. Cause my stroke order, man, is messed up. So messed up.
So that's when you're learning kanji. There's a number of strokes, but you have to do them in order. And actually, I think the order you write them in helps you to write them more cleanly, more beautifully. There's a lot to learn. Funnily enough, when I was at uni, I had a really weird degree. I did what's called a major and minor, a major in music and a minor in Japanese. So like 70% of my marks was music and 30% was Japanese. And I think I was the first person in my university to do that.
That's so cool, man.
Yeah, it was great. And it was a really, really cool mix because I think you might agree that there's a crossover between music and language learning. Obviously, there's the oral aspect of it, our ability to, we're trained musicians, right? So we spend a lot of our time listening very carefully to sounds, whether it's music or, instrumental singing, and trying to identify the pitch or the chord. And I think that does translate over to language learning, because, again, you've got to listen very carefully.
100%.
So you were like super, you know, motivated to learn Japanese. You were a self-starter. You self-taught yourself. And then after uni, you came to Japan?
Yeah, so I had made up my mind within my first year of uni that, like, okay, that's going to be my thing. I'm going to go to Japan and I'm going to try and do something in Japan. Because being from kind of from Yorkshire, you know, I don't want to say I was untraveled, I certainly wasn't like, I've only been to London maybe two or three times in my life. And I think two of those times were to get my visa application sorted to come to Japan. So it's like, you know, it was a big move, really. I graduated university. I knew I was going to graduate like probably about a month before I finished because I was always doing quite well at uni. I think I was one of the kind of top guitar players there. So it was kind of like I knew I was going to graduate. So I went ahead and I got the working holiday visa. I don't know if that's still a thing.
I think so. I'm not sure. I know they have a nomad visa.
Oh, I have no idea what that is.
Yeah, no, so the nomad visa was a new visa to encourage, you know, traveling entrepreneurs to come to Japan for 6 months. I think there was the issue with it was that the visa was only 6 months and it took over 6 months to actually apply for it.
Okay.
I think, I don't quote me on this, I think maybe perhaps there's a working holiday visa and I think it's limited to various certain countries, probably like the UK, US, Australia, Canada, various other countries. What is it, like a year or 2 years or something? I forget.
Mine was a year.
It was a year, right. Okay. Mm.
And so I took that and that was like, okay, the only thing you needed to be eligible you needed to have completed your degree.
Yeah.
And so I was able to get my university to basically write a letter to the embassy and say, he's passed. Like, he hasn't graduated yet, but like, we're telling you that we know he's already passed.
Right.
So I was able to get that sorted to where I left the UK probably about 2 days after my final exam. It was like, I finished my exam. I was like, boom, straight on the plane over here.
Wow.
And then I got an email while I was here being like, you've graduated. Well done. Do you want to come to the ceremony? And I'm like, I can't. I'm in Japan. And so it was like, I managed to. And then while I was in the UK, I also managed to find a job teaching English for one of the companies that puts you in like junior high schools or high schools and stuff.
Got it. Yeah. So these are, there are a lot of, what would you call them? Hakken gaisha, which are basically.
That's the one, yeah.
Yeah. And I'm forgetting my English now. Basically, it's a dispatch company. So what they'll do is they have like a roster of English teachers. And what they'll do is they'll send those English teachers to, for example, elementary schools, middle schools, high schools. And sometimes they also do, you know, business classes for adults as well. And so how was that?
Oh man, I really enjoyed it. Like, again, this is my weird thing, you know, because I came from doing music full time.
Yeah.
For me, like, just talking to people in English was really fun. I really enjoyed it. It was like, I really enjoyed it. I thought it was great. And actually I make the joke now, whenever like there's any job that like seems like it could go sketchy, I'm always like, oh, I'll just go back to teaching English. And I genuinely mean that because it was really good fun, man.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed it.
It's I taught elementary school kids.
I don't think I would have enjoyed that though.
Oh, it is intense. It's really intense. But what I did was I was on the JET program where you graduate from university and they send you out to a rural town somewhere in the deepest, darkest Japan. I was in Kyushu and I was lucky because my job was super, super varied. So I'd be teaching elementary school kids one day and sometimes high school another day. And then I'd be planning events like international events and translating for people. It was one of the coolest jobs I had. But one time I went to the, actually I did kindergarten one time And that was the most intense 3 hours I've spent in my life, because those kids are just like full of energy. They're bouncing off the walls. And you're like, quick, stop little Kenta running into the road. Okay. Oh, no. Now Fred's puked up over the piano. Oh, dear. Where's the...
yeah.
Is it lunchtime now? Oh, no.
That's crazy.
One of the kids has gone missing. It was so intense. Yeah. But it was really good fun. And I think also kind of going back to that kind of music language thing, I think as musicians, I think we already have some transferable skills for teaching language. And also we're kind of performing a bit, right? Especially for the younger kids, performing in front of the kids. It was really, really good fun.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. And another thing that would be, are your audience aware that you're like a fantastic guitar player?
I do play guitar, but Timothy, I bow in your presence because I'm not worthy, man. Now, people who already know Timothy know he is a rock star. But yeah, some of your music, man, it's just absolutely incredible. And actually, Timothy, you're one of the people who inspire me to practice more. And at the same time, maybe I should just give up guitar.
Oh man, you're too kind, man. I appreciate that. But to go back to what you were saying about. Yeah, I came to Japan. I had a job in Japan lined up. Mm. And then as soon as I arrived into Japan, I went to the place to do the training and they told me that the job offer fell through and they didn't get the contract.
Oh no.
Yeah. So I didn't have a job basically.
Yikes.
Which is like it was fine. You know what I mean? Like because I already had my visa.
Yeah.
So I was like, okay, well, I've got like a year-long visa and I don't have a job, but I don't have to like leave. If I had come without the visa, expecting them to sponsor my visa, then that would have been really bad because I would have only had 3 months.
Right.
But I still had like a year. Mm. So I spent that year, I found some other jobs like doing the exact same thing, but for a different company, basically.
Right.
But one of the benefits I will say is that because I had that stupid idea that every foreigner in Japan would be like insanely fluent in Japanese, my Japanese was pretty good when I came to Japan.
Yeah, right.
Not to blow my own horn.
Yeah.
It was, and so the thing that is kind of interesting in Japan, which you'll be familiar with this, everyone can, not everyone, but most people can speak English to a basic level. Let's say if 10 is like fluent and 0 is nothing, pretty much everyone in Japan can do a 2 or a 3.
Yeah.
And if you come to Japan and your Japanese is 0 or 1, then your conversation is always going to default to English. Whereas my Japanese, because I thought everyone was going to be really good, was probably about a 3.5.
Yeah.
So the lucky thing for me was whenever I would speak to people, they would realize that my Japanese was a tiny bit better than their English and we'd default to Japanese.
That's good. Yeah.
So, yeah, so it's like, so I've been speaking Japanese every day for 15 years, which has been great. But I meet other people who've been in Japan 30 years who speak English every day because their Japanese was originally like a 1 when they came and their Japanese is still only like a 1.
Yeah, so I've been thinking about this a lot and I think that if you want to speak really good Japanese in Japan, I think, well, I call it the escape velocity Japanese. So what that means is you didn't study Japanese formally, but you really hit the books hard for like 2-3 years, right? So when you got here, again, your Japanese was at that 3 level. You'd achieved escape velocity to be able to hold a basic conversation. No, you know, you weren't completely fluent, but you could hold a basic conversation in Japanese, meaning the other Japanese people spoke to you in Japanese. I did a 1-year intensive studying Japanese in Tokyo, just speaking Japanese every day, and we had loads of homework. That was really intense. And I think if I hadn't have done that, it's likely I would have slid into the group of people who just never really managed to get that escape velocity and just always spoke English. And there are foreigners who live in Japan who've, you know, they come here for many reasons. Maybe they were working for a corporation and they're stationed in Japan as an expat and they're using English all day, and their Japanese colleagues speak really amazing English, and all their customers speak English, and they just never have the, you know, the time to learn it. But I think if you can achieve that escape velocity, which you did, and I think I did, then, like you said, you're going to be speaking Japanese daily to people. And that's where you make real improvement, I think.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. You know, that's, I'm really lucky that I had that weird idea that I needed to be like really, really high level. Right. It wasn't until I got here and then realized that, wow, like foreigners, a lot of the foreigners don't speak Japanese. A lot of them decided they wanted to come to Japan. They came and they're like, oh, I'll pick it up while I'm there. I mean, obviously, everyone defaults to English with you, so you just don't. And then before you know it, 2 years has gone by.
Yeah.
And you know less than you did on the plane coming here, because at least you had a book on the plane and you were reading something. When you get here, you just go back to watching Netflix and in English. Mm. So it's like, and so that was really lucky for me. And that really helped me out with when I ended up moving into the music industry, because obviously the music industry is, it's all in Japanese. So it was like, I needed that initial base level of Japanese. Mm. And so I'm really happy I studied Japanese. And I, like I say, I went full on, not even just with the language, like I was eating all my meals with chopsticks at least 3, 4, or 5 months before I came over here.
Mm, that's amazing.
Because I had this other idea that there would only be chopsticks here. So I was like, okay, I need to get really used to eating all my meals with chopsticks.
Right.
So I was really good with chopsticks as well, man.
No, but I mean, I think that's admirable. You know, the more energy and time you can put into learning Japanese, you know, either before you get to Japan or during your time in Japan, it's all the better. And again, it's like building that escape velocity. Because I think also there's the linguistic fluency, but there's the cultural fluency, right? You know, understand, what do they call it? KY, right?
Yep.
So kukiyomenai.
Kukiyomenai.
Understanding the social situation so you can interact with people and actually understand what they're saying. So you met this Japanese bass player in college. You got hooked on Japan. You hit the books. You got a working visa. Came over to Japan.
Lost my job.
Lost your job.
And then found another one.
And then, so up until then, you'd just been teaching English. Now, how did you make, I guess this is kind of like part two of our conversation, but how did you make the transition from teaching English or that working holiday visa to doing music? Like how did you establish your career?
Yeah, so it's a mixture, and this is probably not a really great answer for most people who are interested in doing that kind of thing, but it's an honest answer. It's a mixture of really, really hard work, luck, and then just also knowing the right people, if you know what I mean. So like the luck element for me was that I came over after the really big earthquake.
Yeah, yeah.
So so there was two people on my flight.
Yeah.
Like it was a huge plane with, you know, 4 seats in the middle, 3 seats either side. And there was two people on my flight. And I brought my guitar over with me and they were just like, yeah, just sit it on one of the chairs. Because they're all, free, you know. And the other guy, and I would love to know if this guy's listening, the other guy on the plane happened to be a bass player.
Oh, no way. Okay, so so if you were a bass player and you were on a plane to Japan with Timothy Reed sitting next to you, what year was this?
2012, just after the big earthquake. Like literally, so possibly 2011, I'm not sure. It was like, it was about a month after, because once that earthquake happened, I remember going to uni and everyone saying to me, well, I guess you're not going to Japan anymore. And I was like, well, I guess I am.
Yeah,
like,
right.
Like no. I'm going no matter what. Like I've been learning Japanese and eating with chopsticks for the last 3 months. I'm like, I'm going.
Yeah.
So and I got off the plane. I was waiting to figure out how to get the train to where I needed to go. And the other guy was there and it was like, wow, we're only two of us on the plane. He was like, are you a guitar player? Because I had my guitar. And he was like, I'm a bass player. I don't have my bass, but I'm a bass player.
There you go. So if
yeah, it's kind of interesting.
So if that guy is listening, reach out to us at info@learnjapanesepod.com. That's info@learnjapanesepod.com. if the mysterious bass player, like, reach out to us. We'd love to talk to you.
Yeah, let's make an album. Anyway, so like, so that was the, that was kind of, it, you know, that was part of the thing. When I came here, it was kind of like there was no foreigners here at that point. Everyone went home.
Right.
So there was, finding a new job was pretty easy because the companies all needed people because everyone left.
Yeah, right.
And I think there was less stress to get my visa changed when I did find a job to like a standard working visa. That all I remember being pretty straightforward.
Yeah.
And so I was kind of lucky then in that sense. And then also because my Japanese was pretty good, that opened up the other things I could do.
Hmm.
And then basically, what I was doing the English thing, and then I would play guitar on an evening. I met a few foreign musicians, and I would play music with them in like foreign establishment, like Western bars, like Irish pubs and things like that.
Right.
And I managed to meet like people who were like on the cusp of being like kind of semi-professional, but also like kind of played in pub bands, basically.
Yeah, right.
They would do like a wedding band and they'd get paid, but they'd also be like a priest and do weddings.
Right. Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
By the way, shout out to all my friends who have done weddings as priests. It's, I think it used to be a very lucrative job, but now these days, less and less people are getting big fancy weddings now. So.
That was a big thing at one point. People just donning the, what's that neck thing that they wear with the white and black?
Oh, yeah, right. Like just, the dog collar, right?
Yeah. And doing marrying people, man. And so I was playing with them and they would play. And so it was like, I met them and I was kind of doing music like on the evenings after work. And then I played a gig with a guy who was a really good guitar player and he would come and jam and we would hang out. And he one day just asked me like out of nowhere, like, are you going to enter this guitar contest, this guitar tornado contest? And I'm like a musician dude. So I'm like super anti-contest.
Right.
I'm like, nah, man, there's no such thing as...
yeah.
You know, better a contest, music contest, it's art, man.
Yeah,
I'm
right,
all hippie-ish
right.
about it. And he was like, yeah, but if you enter it, you get a chance to play through like a Marshall amp, like a stack, like a 4x12.
Wow.
And I was just playing in my room, you know, in Japanese rooms, as you know, like the walls are paper thin, so you can't play through an amp.
Yeah.
And so I was like, oh, okay, fair enough, sign me up. Just a chance to play through an amplifier sounds cool. So he signed me up for this contest and you had to choose like a song to play. And I didn't even practice a song. It was a Jeff Beck song called Lead Boots that I just knew it because I'd heard it, but I've never even played it before.
Yeah.
I just knew the song in my head. And I went to the audition with my guitar and just plugged in and I just played. And then sure enough, I got through to the next round, and then I would go to that and got through to the next round. And the whole time I wasn't thinking about winning at all. In fact, I probably seemed like a bit of an ass, to be honest with you, because I would turn up there and everyone would be like sat with the music practicing and I'd just be kind of like walking around talking to people, like asking like, how are you doing, man? Like that's a nice guitar. Like not interested at all. And then to cut a long story short, basically I got through to the final, and then in the final, I don't want to get too technical, but I was doing dumb stuff. Like they asked me when I wanted to play, do you want to do the album version or the live version?
Oh,
and
wow.
I gave a really stupid answer. I was just like, just feel it, man. You know, like we just like the dumbest thing ever.
In Japan, sometimes musicians can get a bit lost in the weeds. It's like, you're going to play the studio version or the second studio version or the EP version or the live version or the live version in Dusseldorf. And you're like, well, I mean, yeah.
Exactly. It's improvisation is just not a part of... No, I mean, I don't know. It might be in some elements, but in the music thing, like, especially in pop music and like rock music, there is no real... The people who are into improvisation, but they're not into like... They're into like the New York jazz thing some experimental thing. It's not like a Japanese thing. So, yeah. And so when I did that, I think like, I was like in the middle of the song, I was like, oh, the bass player can just sit out and me and the drummer will just kind of, let's just go off. And then we'll just bring it back to the head of the song.
Yeah.
And I did that.
And it just so happened that the main judge of the contest was like a bebop trumpet player who worked for Korg.
Oh, wow.
And so he watched that. And I think he'd sat through, you know, however many album versions of Little Wing by Jimi Hendrix that you can all day. And then this random foreign dude just gets on stage and like tells the bass player to go away and just starts playing random stuff with the drummer. And he just dug it. So I think he kind of decided like, okay, he's the winner.
Wow.
Purely on the fact that it was like kind of just really out there.
Yeah.
And then he came up to me after the thing and was like, if you ever want to do any in-store demonstrations and you record an album, just let me know. And it's funny because I had my album that I had done for university. Mm. So for my university project, I made an album.
Wow.
And I had that in my bag. And I was like, well, I'll stop you right there. I have this right here. And he was like, wow, can you do a demonstration next week? And I was like, yes, I can. And so
that's interesting.
Yeah. And so he was just like, I got an email and he was like, yeah, come to the headquarters and pick up some guitars and then see if you like any of them. And then just bring that to the demonstration and then play a song. And maybe you can do he called it a 1 point lesson, which was just like, talk about something. And so I just did that for about 6 years.
And were you mostly doing guitar demonstrations? That was your kind of main gig?
Yeah, because it started for like a one company, and then like Korg owned a lot of other companies back in the day. Like they were a part of a few companies. She's kind of common in Japan. It's like you have one high company, and then that company will own like a set of bass companies, a set of keyboard companies.
Right.
And so I would do like for all the companies, and then they would be friends with some amp company and they would hook me up with them. And then I would go and I was on like an artist deal, which meant I got paid for the demonstrations, but I didn't actually own any of the gear. So the gear was all lent to me, which was great because I had no money because I would teach in English and I was struggling. But I had all this really cool music gear. And then, you know, through doing that job, because the 1 point lessons, I'm not a great teacher, but I could speak Japanese.
Yeah,
right. So I would do these Japanese lessons and I would talk about some song that I just played and some of the scales, and someone had asked me a question and I'd try and answer it. And then I think it was Nagoya School of Music was kind of interested in me going and teaching there.
Mm.
So I started teaching there, and then they were like, oh, if you do like a year here, we can eventually move you to Osaka School of Music. So I did that. And then there was like Yamaha, who also had me teaching there.
Wow.
And my Japanese wasn't like great. But again, like you said, man, like musicians have a benefit because we're quite good at being prepared to be unprepared, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, right.
You know, like, and so I would go there, someone asked me a question and I'm like, okay, I don't know how to say, I don't know, tritone substitution in Japanese, but I do know how to say, like, rather than play this note, you can play this note.
Yeah, right.
And it's like...
Paraphrasing.
Yeah, exactly. You know, just like finding your way around it. And that's like... That's another really big skill that I think that's really important that a lot of people I meet who I go to university, and again, I'm jealous of people who studied at university, but sometimes I'll be in a restaurant and I'll be with someone who studied Japanese at university and they'll be sat there umming and ahhing trying to think of like the perfect kanji to order this meal. And then I'll just be like, I'll just have that yellow thing there with the cream on top, which is... You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's paraphrasing. I think the skill to be able to paraphrase is a superpower. It really is, because when I taught English a million years ago, a lot of my Japanese students who were learning English, they'd kind of get caught up on the same thing, that they felt to be good in English, you need to learn complex words, difficult words, TOEIC 990 words. And I'm like, no, just paraphrase. And one of my students, she was really good at that. She actually forgot the word dustbin or waste paper bin or something.
Garbage can
to our American friends. She forgot the word garbage can. And when she actually said, oh, can you pass me the thing you put the old paper in? I'm like,
yeah,
and I was
exactly.
like, that, and she kind of pointed, and I totally understood what she meant. It wasn't perfect English, but the whole point was she communicated. So yeah, anyway, paraphrasing is a superpower. You should definitely use it, especially you, dear listener, when you're learning Japanese. If you don't know the difficult kanji, just use simple words to express what you want. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's... And so that's what I was reasonably good at. So I was able to get jobs at teaching at various like schools and stuff purely because of that. And I could even take it even further than that. Like even my job interview, like I would kind of feel like I had the job before I finished the interview because I'd make small talk with the person.
Yeah,
and
right.
they even just because the small talk, they'd be like, yeah, this guy's all right. You know what I mean? This guy's cool. Like he's a nice guy and... yeah, this is going to work. And they hadn't even asked me any questions yet.
Yeah.
Whereas if I'd have studied the perfect word for each question and waited, I'm not sure if it would have turned out right. But going into an interview and just being really friendly and you know, saying something like, I don't know, oh, the sandwich shop over the road, does it do like a cheese and ham sandwich? Yeah. you know what I mean? It's like, and they'd be like, I don't know, I think it does. Yeah, it's like, they already know, well, he can speak Japanese because he just asked me if the shop across the road does a cheese and ham
right.
sandwich. And
right.
that's, you know, so it's things like that.
I think maybe just being open, having good communication skills. And also, actually, this kind of takes me to my next question. Like, as a foreigner in Japan, and I guess you could apply this to anything, you know, breaking into the music industry or just making a living in Japan. What have you found are the benefits and the challenges of being a foreigner in Japan?
So, I mean, yeah, there are obviously a lot of benefits and there are obviously a lot of challenges as well. But one thing that I will say that I only learned, I say recently, within the last 5 years, is that when I was at university, I got really heavily into bebop jazz music.
Wow.
And
cool.
Yeah. And I thought that like, there was like a good 2 years where I didn't listen to any music that didn't have a horn in it. I was like, if it doesn't have a horn, it's not real music. And I became essentially what people would call a jazz snob.
Yeah,
right. I didn't listen to the Beatles. I didn't listen to Oasis. I didn't listen to The Cure. I just listened to jazz music. And when I came to Japan, I still kind of had that mentality that the highest form of music was bebop
right,
jazz music.
Right.
And so I would go to, whenever I would go to like the music schools, they would be like, they'd see my name on the page and they'd be like, British born guitar player. And I'd walk in and they'd be smiling and they'd be like, oh, great British born guitar player. And this, I only learned this after when I got into the video game industry. And this is,
yeah.
I would go in there and they would ask me, so what kind of music do you play? And I'd be like, well, you know, I'm really into Charlie Parker. I'm really into, you know, Dizzy Gillespie and John Coltrane. I would list all these American jazz artists and they would, their happy face would go slowly to a frown and a sad, and I wouldn't know why for a long time. When I started applying for jobs in the music, in the game industry, I decided that I'd stop the whole jazz snobbery thing. And I got back to listening to like classic music, like Rolling Stones and good old bands.
Yeah.
And so when I went for the job interviews, they'd have the same happy face. And rather than start banging on about some jazz artist and how they changed music and man, that's, you know, I would just say, I'm just a rock guitar player, British rock guitar player. And they would go like Eric Clapton. And I'd be like, yeah, like Eric Clapton. And they'd be like, where do I sign? You know what I mean? Like, you're in, man. You're in. You're the authentic British rock guitar guy. Like, you're what we need. And so to answer your question, it's like, yeah, like I, for some reason, I played down my biggest benefit, which is the fact that people have this idea of what they want from someone when they see what they do and their name and everything.
Yeah.
If you play into that and you give them what they expect, there's
right.
a good chance that you'll get hired or you'll get paid or that things will come of it. Whereas if you try and push against it because you've got some kind of, you know, thing that you're into at the moment, unfortunately, it can kind of work against you. And I probably lost a lot of gigs and a lot of jobs just because they were expecting a British rock guitar player. And I went in there trying to talk about all this other stuff where I should just really like kind of, you know, be happy and satisfied with the fact that, well, I'm from a country that's known for rock guitar and I'm a rock guitar player. So,
you know, it's kind of like sell, you know, what's easy to sell. I think when I lived in Osaka, I did a jazz duet. I played guitar and accompanied a singer. She's a Japanese girl. She was fantastic, fantastic singer. And we did jazz, you know, just jazz standards, everything from Autumn Leaves to Night Train, like whatever, right? So we did, we'd do like an hour. We had an hour set and we'd go around whiskey bars and restaurants and clubs and stuff. We did it for about a year. It was really, really good fun. And the really telling thing, and this just always made me laugh. It's like, we did jazz because we wanted to do jazz, and I knew a bit of jazz and she loved jazz, and that's what we decided to do. And then when it came to the end, when we took requests, 9 times out of 10, Beatles.
Yeah. Mustang Sally.
Yeah, exactly. Play Freebird. Like, you go to the States, play Freebird, man. I think there's a deeper thing that you're getting at is when you're in Japan. Japan is the land of harmony. It's not about pushing your individual desires and ideas on the group. It's kind of more going with the flow. And it's really funny you come up with this story, because someone else before, when I was gigging, said, oh dude, you know, you need to really kind of sell yourself as a British rock guitarist, you know, like Rolling Stones and Oasis and all that stuff. And I had the same thing you did. It's like, no, oh, but I want to do jazz or, you know, heavy metal. It's like, dude, would you like to eat or not?
Yeah, no, 100%. It's, and that even goes further. That even goes into language. Like, there was another, probably I'd say around 8 years when I came to Japan, where like I had an ego for speaking Japanese and I didn't want to speak in English, and I would speak in Japanese to people. And it's only recently that I realized that, like, when someone speaks in English to you, they really, really want an English response. They want you to respond in English. Yeah. Not for any kind of ego. They just want to experience it, and they want to know that they kind of achieved, like, I gave this guy a coffee and I said, here you go. If you reply with, thank you very much, you'll see there, you've made that person's day.
Yeah, happy. 100%. There are some foreigners I've met who get angry where they don't look Japanese, right? And a Japanese person assumes they speak English, which they might not. Maybe they're French or something, right? And the Japanese person speaks English to the foreigner and they get upset. Oh, I'm in Japan and we're speaking. Blah, 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 blah. And I'd like to say my official policy on this is, dude, chill. It's fine. Just answer in English. We're just communicating. And like you said, you'll make their day.
You'll make their day.
It's fine. It's fine. People, it's fine.
It's fine. Like, honestly, it's fine. I studied those kanji books so hard. But yet, I've got the choice of, you know, like, making myself happy and speaking in Japanese. Or I can just make someone else's day by just being like, cheers. That's another one. So I kind of, I'll flip it sometimes. I'll be like, okay, I think that person speaks a bit more English than they're putting on.
Yeah.
So they'll give me something and I'll be like, cheers. And I can see the cogs working in their brain. They're thinking, cheers, that means kanpai.
Yeah.
But I'm giving them a coffee and it's not alcoholic.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
maybe cheers means thank you.
Yeah.
And then they'll be like, oh, I remember hearing someone else say that. You know what I mean? Mm. And then you can see they start smiling and they're like, oh, he just said thank you to me in a different way. And they've learned a new word. And it's like, you've just made someone's day. Anyway, sorry, going off on a tangent.
I think this is a really good point, because talking about like the Japanese personality or mindset, like a lot of people say, well, Japanese people are very shy and Japanese people tend to hide their emotions, a bit like Brits. And maybe in some circumstances that's sometimes right. I tend to find that Japanese people have a really good sense of fun. And if you meet them at the same energy, whether they're talking to you in Japanese or English, if you can meet them there, they love it.
Yeah, I agree 100%. So
partly because they're hanging out with a weird foreigner who just looks really weird. So
yeah, exactly.
We've gone from your background in music, coming to Japan for the first time, you know, struggling to put your roots down and make a career. You started teaching English, and then you managed to get into, you know, the music industry through, you know, gigging and doing guitar demonstrations, which is so cool, and getting to play in all this cool equipment. But then after that, you kind of transitioned from music into the video game industry. Could you tell me a bit about that?
Yeah, so it was because of COVID more than anything.
Right.
When COVID hit, obviously we weren't able to gather people together in the music stores anymore.
Got it. Yeah.
Or in the convention centers, you know, like to do the music events where all the companies gather together. So slowly but surely, what started as like 4 demonstrations a month turned into 3, turned into 2, turned into 1. And then sure enough, it was like, okay, you know, I wouldn't have demonstrations for like 6 months, and I'd be sat on all my gear thinking, am I going to get a letter saying, okay, can you return all your gear, please?
Right, right. And
there was a good like 2 years where I was okay, but then sure enough, the message came, can you send back all the gear? Because, you know, we're not using it and stuff. And so it's like, okay. I kind of, in that 2 year period, I started doing like session guitar stuff, recording. And so I was like doing a lot of online collaboration recording. And I think I played on, well, I played on a lot of songs, and I said this on another podcast, but like in probably about a year, less than a year, maybe half a year, I played on about 700 songs.
Wow.
And the reason why I know that is because I have a folder on my computer where I just, whenever I record a new song, I'll create a project, you know, and I'll just save it in there.
Yeah.
And I was literally deleting. I just highlighted everything to delete all the projects.
Yeah.
And it was like it was 700 and something songs. And that's not like 700 songs that I wrote, but like I might have played acoustic guitar,
right,
or I might have played rhythm guitar, or I might have done a guest guitar solo, or, you know, I might have even played bass or programmed drums on some of them. But there was a good 2 years where I was doing that, trying to see if that could possibly be a revenue stream, because obviously that doesn't necessarily need to be in Japan.
Yeah.
You could do that wherever.
Yeah.
But it was hard. Like, there is a lot of people who weren't willing to really pay for like the session guitar thing anymore.
Right.
And I was trying to weigh it up. Like, I would be like, okay, well, this guy, I know he wants to do an album, so I'll do 3 songs for free. And then after that, I'll say, any chance you can throw me some money. But, you know, it was tough. And so basically, I just had to look for other things to do. And I managed to find a job working for a games company because they needed a transcriptionist. They needed someone to transcribe music and make the sheet, write the sheet music so that they had it on file. So again, I initially went in there as a transcriptionist working for a company called Ubisoft.
Yeah.
It's a French games company.
Right.
And then again, through that, I also would, they knew I played guitar. So they're like, oh, maybe you can record some of the guitar for these songs. And then, they realized that I was quite fast at recording guitar. And that was because I've been doing it for like 2-3 years prior doing the session stuff. Mm. So I was already had my kind of recording head on. You know what I mean? Where it's like, I've got it in 3 takes. Mm. I know what I'm doing. I have all my gear set up. Mm. And then after that, I was able to start composing for video games. So doing like my own video, like game composition stuff. And then unfortunately, I lost the job at that company because like the whole company kind of went through changes. Mm. And the whole like place where I was at, the studio I was working at got shut down. And I was just getting into kind of like audio implementation, which is like kind of putting sounds in video games. That was something else that I was interested in learning and thought that I could do that through the company. And then I had the decision after that as to whether I wanted to either go back to like more musical stuff, or try and continue in the video game industry, maybe working for a different company or doing some freelance stuff. So I moved into freelance, pretty much doing everything. So doing sound design, composition, Foley stuff, which is kind of like walking around with a big boom mic that you see people doing, recording like people walking and doors and birds singing, all that kind of stuff. And then also implementation, so like, which is using like middleware and using the Unity and Unreal, these gaming engines, and putting sounds in game. And there's a lot of crossover with all of that stuff, because you need musical ability. Like if someone says to you, okay, I need you to make reverb volumes, like reverb zones for this level. If you don't know what reverb is, you're going to have a really hard time figuring out what reverb would work for a level. But if you know, musicians kind of, we know that stuff from playing in clubs. We know that, well, this is a small club and the walls are concrete, so it's going to be a pretty hard, harsh reverb. You know, we're going to have a very short pre-delay on it, you know. And or if it's in a cave, we know that, okay, so this can be way more spacious. It might also, we might EQ the reverb, take out some of the highs so that it's more boomy. And so that's something that's really important for like audio designers, sound designers and stuff like that. So there's a lot of skills that cross over. And then, of course, you know, the icing on the cake is that I'm in Japan doing this. So a lot of the companies I'm working with are Japanese companies. So having that ability in Japanese to talk about that stuff as well. And again, that whole being able to paraphrase is super important, because when you're talking to a 2D engineer, they have so many words that that no one is ever going to learn. You could get like the best N1 speaker from a really good university. You give them a textbook, a Japanese textbook on 2D animation. I mean, you could give me a textbook in 2D animation in English. I probably wouldn't understand a lot of the jargon in it because it's so specific.
Yeah,
it's so unique.
I think it's worth obviously studying general Japanese, but if you can, it's actually good to sometimes learn very specific industry Japanese for your industry, because it does give you that extra edge. But at the same time, once you've learned that and you need to explain these concepts to someone who doesn't know that, again, you're using paraphrasing or, you know, finding other words to describe these things. It's a superpower, totally.
It is a superpower. And I did the same thing with music. So when I was like touring and like working with the Japanese overseas students in the UK, I would ask them like, how do I say pentatonic scale in Japanese? And they would be like, go on onkai.
Yeah.
And then they would be like, but we don't say that. We say pentatonic.
Yeah, right.
Because, you know, it's a Western thing. Yeah. And so I kind of had all those musical words when I came to Japan originally. And so exactly as you said, like, you know, I've never advised anyone on learning Japanese because I don't think I'm qualified at all. However, if I was to have some advice, it would be, try and specialize.
Yeah,
try and specialize in something. It doesn't matter what it is. It could be like medical words.
Yeah, right.
Just like medical tests and like hospital-based vocabulary. Mm. Because you don't know when it could come important. Like,
for example, medical words are actually super useful, because guess what? You might get sick and need a hospital, so you need to know the difference.
Or your friend might get sick, or someone in your company might get sick, you might be the guy or the girl.
Yeah.
It's like, can you take them to the hospital?
And translate for them.
And translate.
Yeah, right.
And if you do it and you nail it, and then it's like, oh, I can do that for anyone else. And then it's like, wow, you've just made a job for yourself in this company, being the kind of the Ningen doc, you know, the yearly health check. You take people and it's like you've got more of a reason to be in the company than just, oh, you can do the same job that everyone else can. I mean, it could be anything. It could be car mechanic stuff. For me, obviously, it was musical related stuff, like music theory, which really helped me in the demonstrations, because I already had those music theory words. And so it was just putting them into practice and actually using them. And more often than not, people would just be like, we don't say that word, man. We just use the wasego, you know, the English katakana version.
Right.
But knowing those words like built character. It gave me a reason to be doing that job. It was like, yeah, man. And so right now I'm still working in the video game industry, doing like video game projects, which is really fun. And it's, again, it's a interesting situation, because if I didn't do the music university degree, I would never have met a Japanese overseas student and became interested in Japan. So I would never have come to Japan. If I didn't work in the English school and then have the kind of, have to get into this like foreign music scene with wedding bands and things like that, I would have never have met those people who turned me on to playing gigs with a Japanese band, who then told me to do this Japanese guitar contest. And so everything kind of lends into the other stuff, if you know what I mean.
So, Timothy, I have a couple more questions for you. Again, really talking about your career as both a musician and, you know, producing games. Number one, what is your advice to someone trying to break into the music industry in Japan? And number two, if I'm sure there are people who are interested in getting into the games industry, same question about the games industry. If you're talking to someone who is thinking of getting a job in the games industry, again, what's your advice?
In regards to the music industry, the music industry is like hit and miss. And I honestly don't know if I had stayed in the UK, if I had would have been able to make a career in the music industry over there.
Right.
So my journey has been really unique. And I think part of the reason why my journey worked out is because of that uniqueness.
Yeah, right.
You know what I mean? And so... If someone wanted to come to Japan and work in the music industry in Japan, my advice, purely from my perspective, would be to learn Japanese, which seems kind of obvious, I imagine, to a lot of people, but learn Japanese. But I'll go one step further. I'll say learn really functional Japanese, like we said before about like paraphrasing and stuff.
Yeah.
Go ahead and read the kanji books, learn the kanji books, write the kanji, all that stuff. Use the apps that teach you the Japanese that everyone else knows. But I would go out and I would get in touch or watch videos of Japanese musicians, Japanese guitar players, Japanese bands, and just look for commonalities, like common threads in the video. Like, for example, riha, which is rihasaru, which is rehearsal. So riha, it might not be obvious to someone, even who's a musician, that riha means rehearsal. But it's kind of like a shortened version. It's something that I you see all the time in when you go on, when you're talking to musicians. Oh, riha wa itsu desu ka? When's the rehearsal?
And
but if you were to go online and watch a few videos or read a few blogs or anything like that, you'd probably quickly stumble upon that word and then find out what it means. And so you can kind of shortcut, you know, stuff by getting in there and doing that stuff. So my advice straight away would be just to try and get as much exposure as you can. And with the internet, you can get a lot of exposure. Like you can search this stuff, find out how you search sound check in katakana. How do you write sound check in katakana? Learn how to write it, search it on YouTube and watch some videos, because it will probably be someone on YouTube who's filmed a sound check, and you'll hear people speaking in Japanese, and you'll start to see what a Japanese sound check looks like and what a Japanese live house looks like. Because I didn't know when I came to Japan that all live houses have a JC120, the Roland amp. Like, that's not a thing in the UK, but in Japan, every live house has a JC120, jazz chorus amp. So if you know that, you don't have to come to Japan and be worried about buying an amp or saving, because you know that there's going to be one there.
The drum kit
will be in pristine condition, because that's just a Japanese, you know, all of those things. So that's the first thing I would suggest. The other thing as well is, and this goes back to what I was saying before, is understand your worth and your importance.
Yeah.
And by that, I mean, like, what do you have that a Japanese company or a Japanese band or a Japanese record label would want? For me, there's this history of British rock music. And and so rather than push that away, accept it and be prepared to have a conversation with someone who loves British rock music. Because if you do, you'll make their day, you'll make them happy, and they'll want to be around you, they'll want to talk to you again. And that could be the difference between them hiring you or them deciding, actually, we don't need this person anymore.
I think that's really good advice, because, you know, even if we were just talking about, you know, making it in the music industry in the UK as a Brit, I think some of the advice is still the same. It's like, you know, what is unique about you and your set of skills? Because there's 100 drummers, there's 100 guitarists, there's 100 bass players who could take your space. So like, what is it about you that makes you unique? And in Japan, it might be, yeah, you're a British rocker and you speak Japanese really well. So
yeah, totally.
Yeah, uniqueness is very important.
It could be that you're from the southern states and they're like, oh, cool. And you go to the interview wearing a cowboy hat. It sounds ridiculous. But honestly, like, it sounds ridiculous. But if it's the right place and the right time, there are people who will hire you purely on the fact that, well, he looks the part.
Yeah.
And he sounds the part.
Yeah.
Or she sounds the part. You know, it's, I'm not saying playing to like stereotypes, but know your worth, your natural worth. And then anything on top of that, Japanese ability, being good at your instrument or being like prompt or being on time, all of that is just icing on the cake to what they were already expecting.
It's like being on time. That makes me laugh, because it's just like, dude, just turn up on time, have a shower every day.
yeah, all those normal things.
Just all those kind of basic things. And like, if you're easy to work with, you get a follow-up call.
Oh, 100%.
And if you're difficult to work with and you have a bad attitude and you're walking around like a rock star, you won't get that second phone call, yeah?
No, 100%. And you know, you don't have to, like, you know, not say things that you don't think. You don't have to do that. But it's just about being honest and not trying to put up like a kind of facade or like, you know, a kind of, yeah. And so in regards to the music industry, if you are genuine and you love Japan and you love music, then something will come, like good things will come of it. And I'd go one step further, and I'll say something else. And this is a deep topic, and it bringing it up at the end of the conversation is probably not the best place to do it. But what I see very often with musicians in Japan is that they have to make a decision quite quickly on in their career. And that's that they have to either choose music or Japan. And this is a topic for maybe another discussion, but it's something that people are worth thinking about. If you come to Japan, and it could be anything, I see it with video game people too, there becomes a point where you have to choose what's more important to you, music or Japan. For me, I had to make that decision, and my decision was Japan. The reason why my decision was Japan is because music was something that I did. It's something I do to make a living, and it, you know, would do it regardless. Japan, on the other hand, is that's where I want to live. This is where I want to be. This is my life. So again, I know musicians who've had hard times, and it's like, oh, you're going to have to go back to teaching English, and so they leave the country. Whereas for me, the idea of going back to teaching English, I would enjoy it. I would, you know what I mean? I'm like, I'd look forward to that. I haven't worn a suit in years, like 11 years. I'd love to get the suit out. I don't know if it still fits, but you know, so that's another thing to keep in mind as well. As for the video game industry, again, there's a lot of roles within the video industry, game industry, and there's a lot of roles within sound and music in the video game industry. So there's Foley, which is something that I know that you do these podcasts, so you know about voice recording as well. You could even separate that from Foley. Voice recording is its own thing.
Like dialogue editing, Foley, which basically, if you don't know what Foley is, it's basically used for post-production, where you're recording sounds that are basically some kind of interactions with your body. So like footsteps or the sound of cloth on the body or slapping someone. And it was invented by
John Foley. No, I'm only joking.
I think the name of the guy was Foley. I forget. But anyway, yeah. There's dialogue editing, which is like doing podcasts or doing dialogue for movies. There's Foley, which is the sound effects. There's sound design, all kinds of music and post-production you can do. Yeah. Lots of things.
So it's not only writing music, you know, there's a whole host of things that you can do. And again, they're studyable. Like, they're very studyable. You can find so much cool YouTube content and stuff to learn how to do it. And actually, I would go one step further and say that I was very worried when I got into the video game industry. Can I write music for video games? And my worry was more with the kind of like coding, like implementation side. Like, I've never done anything like that. Can I do that? And it was really interesting because the first thing I realized is that that's the easy side of it. As much as I worried about it, I worried so much.
Yeah.
How am I supposed to write a code to get this thing in, you know, this blueprint into this game? And it's like, there's 1,000 YouTube videos on how to do it. The difficult thing is when they turn around and they say, we've got this character, she's from, I don't know, Okinawa, and she's got blonde hair. What's her theme tune? And you will get a blank stare from everyone in the room who's like, where is the YouTube video to learn how to write the song for her? There isn't one, because it...
Right.
But if you, that's so for me, that's the easy thing. That's the thing that I've been doing. So it's, again, it's playing to your strength. You know, if you know that you're a creative person, the creative jobs or finding a job that you can make creative, like, that's the stuff where you'll enjoy doing it and you'll do a good job of it. If you're one of these people who you're good with a computer, implementation is a great place. You don't have to do everything. You could start on one thing and then branch out into other stuff.
I imagine, like, in the games industry, there's a wide selection of skills that you can develop, everything from music production to post-production, coding the games, implementing the sound effects and music, background music into the game, managing teams of coders, all that kind of stuff. It's quite a wide selection of skills. I would imagine, not that I'm in the video games industry myself, but would you agree?
No, I would agree. And I mean, you're to be honest with you, the stuff that you do with the voice recording and editing and putting podcasts out, you know, that's a big part of the video game stuff, you know, the voice recording. So, like, there would be no reason why you wouldn't be able to get into a company and get working straight away. And then you're a great guitar player. So very quickly they'd figure out, oh, we should have this guitar guy playing songs and possibly writing songs too. And so find the thing that you are good at, the thing that you know, and figure out how you can kind of bridge that. And that's the way to go, I think.
I think just to kind of give people a background of the music industry versus the games industry, I'm old enough to remember that when I was in uni, it was still a time where it was maybe not easier, but easier than it is now to make a living in the music industry, either as a performer, as a composer, or someone kind of vaguely, you know, related to the music industry. And then essentially what happened, as everyone knows, is the gaming industry just exploded. And basically now it's got to the point where, in terms of size, the games industry is bigger than the music industry and Hollywood combined. So if you are of a creative disposition, whether it's visual arts or you're a musician, or even better yet, you know, some coding, I think the games industry, although highly competitive, it's a bigger industry, right? So I don't know if you'd agree, but like, to make it as a, for example, a performing guitarist, I would imagine is a lot more challenging than getting into the games industry as, say, a producer or an editor or an artist, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I can testify to that 100%, having done both, like working. And I would go further and say that, like, making it as an artist is one of the hardest things that you can try and do. And,
right.
I'll be honest and say that I essentially failed at it. Like, I couldn't do it. I could not do it. I tried. However, I think failing and succeeding is probably the wrong way of thinking about it. I think it's more like going to the zoo. You don't go to the zoo and then you think, oh, I failed because I left the zoo. You go and you have as much fun as you can.
That said,
I don't have any fun at the zoo because I just feel bad for the animals. But but yeah, and so for me, that's what I try and think about it like. It's like there was a point where I was trying to make it as an artist, maybe 3 years where I was really trying and it was tough. And then it got to a point where it's like, okay, this is too tough. I want to eat food and not have to worry about my rent. And I want to, and so yeah. And that was when I moved kind of into two other things. But that's not to discourage anyone from doing it. But again, in Japan, the rules are slightly different. And that whole playing to your strengths thing becomes way more of a big deal in Japan. And so if you're going to come to Japan and if your idea is to work as an artist or any kind of creative job, really, really look at yourself from an outside perspective and consider what are your selling points? What are you bringing? You know, are you funny? Are you interesting? Are you super attractive? Are you just quirky? You know what I mean? And then decide, okay, do I want to play on that strength? Because if you don't, that's fine. But you may be kind of almost giving yourself a disadvantage by not playing into it.
Right. And would you hire you? Would you hire you for your company? Be honest, right?
I would hire me in an instant. And the reason for that is because I'm a workaholic. So like I went on a Foley recording trip to Nagano.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, we had to go up there and record Foley. And I literally, on the Shinkansen, about 30 minutes before arriving back in Osaka, happily closed my laptop, took my headphones off, and said to the rest of the team, I'm finished. I'm done. I just mixed all the things that we recorded in Nagano. I just mixed them all.
Yeah, nice.
And they were all like, man, you know, but that's... You know, that's been my mentality. It's like, it's kind of cut and dry. It's black and white. If you want to do something, do it. Get it done to the best of your ability because you'll just kick yourself if you don't, and you'll never know how much you could have done and how well you could have done it. And so, again, this is why this is still my first time into Japan, to round this back to the start of the interview. This is why I haven't left Japan in 15 years, and this is still my first time in Japan. Because when I decided I was going to move to Japan, it was all or nothing. It was either I'm going to go to Japan and I'm going to fail and be homeless, or I'm not going at all. And again, the earthquake happened, but it didn't stop me. It's like, no, I've made up my mind. This is what I'm going to do. And so you don't have to be that serious about it as I am, but I think you do have to at some point decide, like, okay, I'm gonna, like you said, hit the books hard, I'm gonna practice hard, I'm gonna get into this, I'm gonna, you know, and it pays off, and people they can see that you've put in the effort. I think
one thing you're talking about, and it's almost actually, I think it's a Japanese trait, and it's working on yourself, it's honing your skills. It's trying to take yourself to the next level. I find Japanese people are very diligent in wanting to learn new things and improve their skills. And I think with you, you know, you mentioned that part of it is luck, but I would say that some of that luck is because you work so hard. You know, the harder you work, the luckier you get. But Timothy, this is a really educational, this has been a really educational and inspirational story. I hope people listening to this get some ideas and, you know, recommendations on how they could come to Japan and make a career here. So just my last question really is, you know, again, you've had a really interesting and varied career, you know, producing video games, kind of like, I guess I could call you a creative director, right? But what are your plans for the future? What do you see yourself doing from now?
I'm really enjoying doing the indie video games, to be honest with you, because I get so much more creative freedom than when I was working for the bigger companies, when you're kind of focused on one small task. And so I think I just want to, you know, keep doing that, but I also want to try and figure out what my sound is in regards to to that job, what my style is. You know, I think that there's, that as a musician, you're always evolving. And I think that like, that's that idea of an evolving sound doesn't just have to be as an artist or like a writer. It can be in all elements. Like, so how do I think video games should sound? How do I think, you know, and trying to create a style or a kind of, you know, a sound like that, I guess. I mean, it's hard to explain, but...
Finding your voice.
Finding your voice. Perfect. That's it.
Yeah. Finding your voice. Wow. Well, Timothy, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. Listen, we have to hang up face to face, maybe record a video. I think that'd be fun.
That would be great.
Whether that's in Tokyo or maybe I can rock down to Osaka, and we should definitely hang out again. But again, thank you so much. That this was such a fun podcast and I learned a lot, actually. So arigato gozaimashita.
No, thank you.
How can people find you online? Where are you? What platforms are you on?
So I'm notoriously bad at any kind of online promotion, but I got a website, which is timothyreed.com, which is R-E-I-D,
right.
timothyreed.com. And I'm going to start updating that a bit more. I've been a bit hands-off with it at the moment, but that's pretty much the place where you can see all my discography and then a lot of the stuff. There was tour dates on there when I was touring, but I think at like 2019 or something, it just stops. And it's like the COVID, it just stops. So,
right.
There's a lot of stuff there where people can find out. So yeah.
That's great. Yeah. So I guess you might be updating your site, but it's there, timothyreed.com, as you said, R-E-I-D. Yeah.
That's cool. Right.
Awesome. Listen, and if you've got any other links, do tell me. I will stick them on the blog post for this podcast. And dear listener, just remember you can find this podcast at learnjapanesepod.com. You'll see it at the top of the podcast list. Just click on it and you'll see all the links to Timothy's fantastic stuff. So again, Timothy, thank you so much. Dude, let's hang out sooner than later. And I will buy you a beer as a thank you.
Thank you very much, Alex.
Thanks. So see you next time. And dear listener, thank you very much for listening. We will be back with more lessons and fun Fridays sooner than you can say heavy metal rock star. Anyway, see you guys soon. Mata ne. Bye bye.